This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. Today I'm speaking with Spencer Clavin, host of the Young Heretics podcast, assistant editor of the Claremont Review of Books and the American Mind, and author of Music in Ancient Greece, Melody, Rhythm, and Life. We discuss the role music played in the ancient world, the new discoveries that have been found in this previously mysterious field, as well as the fascinating intersection between music, cosmology, and education.
Greek music, ancient Greek music, until very recently, people just assumed that they didn't know what it sounded like, and we didn't know much about it, right?
Yeah, that is true to a certain extent. I mean, one of the things that is funny when you tell people that you study ancient Greek music is still often the first thing they'll say is, oh, but we don't have any music left over, so you must just be studying kind of thought about music or what have you. And it's always tremendously exciting and surprising to a lot of people to say, no, actually, there are 61 documents of ancient Greek music. They had a music notation system. They wrote down, some amount of their music. And they also, of course, had a vast corpus of sort of theorizing about music that helps us to understand how to read those documents. And those documents have been around since, the 1700s. They've been in the scholarly bloodstream. And if you talk to experts on ancient Greek music, they will say, yes, we have written music. But we have moved recently, I think, in a direction both toward kind of a more scientific understanding of how to interpret those documents. And I think we have a lot of scholars out there that are working right now to kind of make that research a little bit more accessible. That's sort of part of my mission here is to do this in a way, you do need to specialize in order to kind of grasp the subtleties, the mathematical and musical subtleties of the whole thing. But there are things that can be brought here into the public sphere in a way that there really haven't been yet. But they're there, and they're very exciting. Some of the best stuff that survives from antiquity, in my opinion.
So what new things have we gotten for the technology and discoveries? Like what's happened recently that has illuminated more this mysterious world?
So one of the great features of the school, so the study of ancient Greek music, is that it incorporates kind of, every branch, things that are typically thought of as separate branches of classics. So archaeology and philology proper, the study of texts, but then also kind of, I'm not even sure what you call it, the practical or artistic study of the ancient world, which is of course also a strand, a long-lived strand of classical tradition to put on Greek plays and to try to imagine yourself into the world of ancient Greece. So all of those things are involved in trying to get a handle on just what the Greeks did with their music, why music was so important to them. And recently, I think some of the ways that we're able, especially to deal with archaeological finds, have kind of taken that whole interaction to the next level. So I'm thinking here especially of the work of a scholar named Stefan Hagel, but he's assisted in this by a whole number of other names like Sylvain Perrot, Callum Armstrong, Barnaby Brown, James Lloyd. I'm just trying to like not forget anybody. I'm sure I'm forgetting people who are doing this, So Hagel especially is known for his work on alloy, which are pipes, sort of one of the two major types of instrument in ancient Greece.
Like the double pipe, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. We call it alloy because there's two of them. The alos would be just one, but usually you have the one going hypothesis, at least, is that you would have a drone pipe and a sort of melody pipe, essentially, and the drone would move stepwise with the melody to keep up. So that's kind of been known for some time. There is a famous alos preserved in the Louvre and a number of others, one at Reading University, for example, some of which date back at least as early as 4th century BC, probably earlier. And one of the great pieces of information that those finds give us is the distance between the holes on the pipe, right? Because that's how you fix pitch. And Stefan Hagel is well known for kind of using both statistical analysis, but then also kind of very careful autopsy, very careful sort of measurement, computer measurement of that distance to calculate just not, first of all, like you know, questions of absolute pitch. So how high or how low are these instruments playing? But then, of course, the question everybody's really excited about, which is questions of relative pitch, and sort of how does the scale exactly work? And so that's an example. You know, once you do that, you can do what, for example, Barnaby Brown often does, which is recreate these instruments and try to listen to them, which is obviously tremendously exciting.
And so how do people figure out how to play them? I think I saw a video of one of them, and like, for instance, it required circular breathing and things like that. I mean, did they just guess that it needs circular breathing, or do we know that?
Yeah, so here is, you know, yet another sort of area of classical studies that you know, we have, for example, vases on which aulites, so players of the aulos, are portrayed, and also players of the kithara are portrayed. This is the stringed instrument, or the lyre, it's sometimes called, these various other families of instruments. And from that, we can't obviously get an exact understanding, because, you know, a lot of these depictions are very stylized. But for example, we see how the strap, or the halter, is called the forbea, which sort of holds the aulos in place, would have been used. We have a series of kind of images of aulos players with puffed out cheeks, which is also replicated in our literary sources. And so from descriptions of technique combined with depictions of technique combined with practical experience of trying to, you know, actually play our replicas, we sort of get step by step closer and closer to what we think, you know, how these instruments would be played. The other sort of useful strand of thought here is especially kind of attributed to Armand Dangour, who's my thesis supervisor, fabulous scholar in Oxford, who has done comparative research into, you know, pipe instruments that look a lot like the aulos, the Leonidas, for example, these other sort of similar traditions, some of which are still living. And so that provides this yet another sort of data point about how this stuff could have worked.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if you guys did anthropological studies where you, like, find different people, you know, because if you want to go back in time, sometimes you only have to go to a different place, right?
Yeah.
And you think, like, the didgeridoo uses the circular breathing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so one of the sort of central moments, let's say, or sort of seminal transitions in modern classics is a form of this kind of discovery. I'm thinking here of Perry and Milman Perry and Lord, and this sort of development of what is now called the Homeric question, this whole field of inquiry into just how the Homeric poems were composed and memorized and performed, which was itself a work of comparative scholarship based on the examination of living traditions of sort of bardic traditions, right, of recitation and memory. And yeah, they say the past is another country. And they say, you know, what you've said, which is kind of the converse of that, which is also true, that many countries contain, many nations contain living traditions that go back further than the ones we're used to. And so that's another sort of strand of classical thought, which has existed for a long time, but which comes into conversation with all these other strands of thought to help illuminate Greek music.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking of Bertrand Russell because he talks about that. But ironically, at the time, he said you go to China to go to the past and New York to go to the future. And now it would be the exact opposite. If anyone spent time in Shanghai, it's definitely different.
Interesting. Yeah.
So it goes to show that these things could even change. But I maybe we should back up a bit and just talk about the role that music played in ancient Greece, because like you said, it was part of the Homeric poetry, and I think it's sometimes difficult for modern readers or students to sort of transport their mind into the ancient world, because we are so used to reading Homer and used to reading Sappho or other poetry, and that the music element was so essential, but I don't think people really fully appreciate just how different it was to how we understand it today.
Yeah, that is a hugely helpful question, because, you know, we're here talking, I have just written this book about ancient Greek music, an introduction to it. And one of the things that I thought was sort of the most important thing to get across first and foremost is that when you're talking about ancient Greek music, you're not just talking about like the little sphere of life that we kind of carve out and call it music, right? I mean, we think of music as I go to a concert, or I put on iTunes, or I do whatever to cause there to be you know, melody and rhythm in my life. And maybe there are lyrics, maybe there aren't. When you talk about ancient Greek music, you have to remember that you're looking at a culture that doesn't think about things in those terms. The Greek word musikē, which comes from Musa, right, the muses, literally just sort of describes the whole purview of the ancient muses, the goddesses of poetry and song and dance, but also of history, right? This huge, I mean, almost everything that we would now call the humanities fall under that sort of giant musikē, and that is where we now get our word music. It's kind of, Plato and others have this sort of traditional dichotomy between musikē for the soul and gymnastikē, gymnastics for the body, and that's an education, you know, these two things kind of next to each other. So that's the first thing, is you're looking not just at song and dance instruments, though of course you are, but you're looking at this kind of whole realm of life that has to do with honoring the muses and with creating art and literature and so forth. Within that sort of big, you know, circle, there's a smaller concentric circle, which Plato also sort of indicates to us is more closely what people often mean when they talk about poietikē, poetry, and musikē, music. And that's this kind of combination of logos, rhythmos, and harmonia, the speech, rhythm, and harmony, or something along those lines, right? And that, you know, so now you're talking about what we typically think of as music. But the other thing that we tend to forget, because we always read these texts in school if we're students of classics, is that sort of smaller form of music is already still everywhere in Greek life. It's not just at the theater in, you know, concerts and staged competitions. It's not just in drama, which we sometimes forget that Athenian tragedy is musical theater, but it's also, it accompanies manual labor. It accompanies soldiers out in the field. It's part of the wedding ceremony. It's part of all music, all religious ritual that we know of. And so really this is music as sort of song and dance, is this pervasive kind of just way of living, which reflects the fact that musikē more broadly is almost, you know, one half of life, or like one side of the coin that is life in the Greek imagination, which is a lot bigger than we think of it. Except that if you do think about it, you know, we incorporate music into a whole range of things, sporting events, right, national anthems, all this stuff. So once you get down to thinking of it, one of the benefits of studying Greek music is it kind of explodes your idea about like what music is. It doesn't just live in this little box called music. It's a whole way of life.
Yeah, well, and you know, like, okay, for instance, I'm like many people in this modern world, a big lover of restaurants. Like, I love going to restaurants. I like collecting restaurants. I like traveling the world just to go to restaurants. Sometimes I'll book a restaurant and then book a plane ticket. I mean, that's, I'm a dedicated restaurateur. And you know, for anybody who's worked in restaurants as well, and as I've had also, you realize how important ambience is to the experience of dining and having music on, and you get to decide exactly the kind of mood the restaurant is by choosing the music. So, I mean, it is something I think for people who might not be aware of is happening all the time in our modern society too. We just might not be as conscious of it.
It's such a good point and an excellent comparison. I mean, there are two things to kind of bring up here. One is that what you're describing, that ambiance music in a restaurant, has something like an analog in ancient Athenian culture with the symposium, which is, again, a pretty famous part of ancient Greek history as they go. And this is the kind of genteel upper crust drinking and dinner party that often involves the giving of speeches and the recitation of poetry, but also almost always involves a flute girl or some form of, you know, enslaved person playing music in the background. One difference between that experience and the experience you're describing, which is a telling difference between ancient Greece and modern life, is that in the modern world, that playlist is effectively infinite. We have these very replicable songs, and we can play around with kind of taking this Taylor Swift song and putting it into this cathedral, or taking this Bach cantata and putting it into this public square. That sort of thing does happen, but we have a lot more technology for kind of making songs into these objects that we can pick and choose at will. Not the case in an ancient Greek symposium. You're limited to what your flute girl knows. You're limited to what your dinner guests might be able to reproduce from their own sort of education in youth. But this the principle applies, and that idea of ambiance and mood music is in some sense a Greek idea. It comes down to us very, very distantly, I would argue, from this whole elaborate theory that sometimes we call ethos theory or the theory of modes, in which Greek philosophers love to associate different kinds of music with different kinds of emotional experience, which we still do now. And that's a sort of central Greek way of thinking about music.
So yeah, I think I once read that they would purposely choose different types of music for debates or symposiums and such, depending on how they wanted the conversation to flow.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be careful. I find that I have to be careful here because a lot of philosophers, as they like to do, are keen to kind of make this into a very strict set of rules, right? Plato is famous for this, but Aristotle does it to a certain extent. And there are a few people that outright reject this, one of whom is Aristoxenus, the great kind of treatise writer who gives us a lot of our technical information about how Greek scales worked. He sort of says it's too simplistic to just assign, you know, one mode to one mood. But Plato does. I mean, Plato wants the Dorian mode, which is sort of one way of arranging the Greek scale, to be associated only with manly courage and to therefore be the thing that inspires military daring. All of these sort of associations. But then there are other thinkers sort of whose work is less well preserved, like Damon of Athens, who seem around the same time, the century BC and 4th century BC, to have kind of made looser associations between kinds of music, form, rhythmic forms, melodic forms, and certain moods. And so that certainly is a, you know, some form of that tradition exists in much sort of elite Athenian culture. And we do the same thing. We say, oh, minor key songs sound sad, right? Yeah. And major key songs sound happy. And then when you get into it, it's like, it's actually a lot more complicated than that, but we do have these kind of generalizations.
Danny Elfman does minor with quirky movies that have got Tim Burton, and, you know, John Williams does major and Superman in here.
Yeah, exactly. And different, you know, you get that too. Big, certain artists are known either for their musical inventiveness. So one big name during the 5th century is Timotheus of Miletus, who's famous for kind of messing around with how many strings there are on the lyre so you can play more notes. And Euripides, the famous Athenian tragedian, is supposed to have kind of borrowed a little bit from him. And then you have people who are associated more with kind of the old-fashioned style, like Aeschylus. Again, in all likelihood, the way that these judgments come down to us, it's quite oversimplified. But one of the exciting things about kind of digging up these musical documents is, in some cases, you can actually try to discern whether there's a grain of truth. So we have, for example, a musical document from Euripides, which many scholars think is original and comes from his play Orestes. And there we do see a fair amount of kind of messing around with what you would call the modal forms, which indicates that some of these judgments are at least true in generalities.
Did all the playwrights compose the music as well then? I mean, or did they just write the lyrics and the songs or like?
No, I mean, this is one feature of what we were talking about earlier, that all of this stuff is kind of tied together, poetry and music, rhythm, words, harmony. Just in the Greek language, the fact that vowels, unlike English vowels, Greek vowels have a certain length of time you're supposed to hold them to relative to other vowels. And so composing poetry at all is composing rhythm rather than just kind of what we think of as meter, which is a stress accent. And then the Greek also has a pitch accent, which not many, again, people can learn Greek their whole lives and know how the accents, you know where the accents go, that there's an acute accent on this vowel and a circumflex accent on this vowel, and not know that they're learning the kind of bare outlines of a melodic form, because those accents are pitch accents. And Dionysius of Halicarnassus tells us about, you know, the voice rises on the acute accent and rises and falls on the circumflex accent. They're not just random little markings.
Yeah. Is that kind of like Chinese or like Mandarin and Cantonese, where the different pitches have different meanings?
So great question. Unlike Mandarin and Cantonese, where pitch is constitutive of meaning, so you can say the word ma, for example, in I think five ways and mean five different things. In Greek, that's only rarely true. So in Greek, for example, the word t means either you know, is either a relative pronoun, like something, or it's an interrogative pronoun, like who or what. And the way that you tell is whether there's a little accent on top of it.
We do that in English, though, right? Between like verbs and nouns, we'll change. It'll be the same word, but if it has the accent, it'll become a verb rather than a noun, right? Something like that.
Well, there's something, there's kind of an analog here in English, I think, which is that like one, our question, the shape of our question is just a vocal inflection, right? If I say to you, what's a good example? You're going to dinner, then I'm telling you a thing. But if I say, you're going to dinner, then I'm asking you a question. And that's, you know, there's some meaning that gets communicated in my pitch structure, but it's not the meaning of the words themselves, if you see what I mean. And that's closer to kind of what you're dealing with the Greek pitch accent. And there are all sorts of arguments in ancient Greece about whether you should write your melodies to kind of preserve the general shape of your pitch accents, or whether it's okay to kind of experiment and break it up. One of the innovators tend to like to kind of play around more with divergence from pitch accent. So it sounds different when you sing than when you speak. And we do this too, I think, in English. So like we do it more with rhythm. You know, Taylor Swift, look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me do. Right. There's this weird sort of playing around with how you would typically say it in speech and how she kind of sings that verse. And that there's something kind of akin to that going on in Greek music, but there's a much more strict sort of set of pitch accents that goes along with kind of everything that you write. So anyway, all this is by way of answering your question. Yeah, you know, the music and the lyrics are very closely connected.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing too. Can I just say that, because obviously these things change culturally. So if you spend a lot of time in Australia, you'll find that just about every sentence sounds like a question.
Right.
And when they say a statement, they'll often make it into a question. So you'd be like, "Oh, how good is this beer?" You know, you're like,
right.
but yeah, so it and obviously in Ireland too, you get a lot more pitch and tone just in normal speaking. That would affect the music. And I guess Ireland probably is more famous for lyrical singers, or maybe.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, and then there are all kinds of interesting sort of studies that have been done about, for example, which languages are more conducive to vocal production, to operatic vocal production. You know, it's easier. I'm a singer, so I can tell you it's easier actually to sing in Italian than it is to sing in English, because certain shapes of vowels produce a more open space in your mouth, essentially. How much more so in ancient Greece, right, where there was so much less standardization, and the various different dialects that the Doric and the Ionic sort of shapes of words and so forth leads to a whole different range of ways of saying vowels. The famous Doric alpha, which replaces a lot of betas, that you know you get these different vowels in different words. So yeah, absolutely, these things are culturally connected. And the Greek modes, words for modes, you know, Phrygian, Lydian, Dorian, Ionic, reflect that. They reflect some older awareness that some of these at least are from local cultural traditions.
Yeah, and when I think about archaic Greece, it's a much more society-orientated culture as well. That, you know, you have community and festivals like pretty constantly, more everybody being together as a community pretty regularly. And it's interesting to think what that effect would have. Like, I think I once had somebody tell me that there isn't, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just...
Totally coming. Yeah, okay.
But that, like, there is no such thing as being tone deaf. Like, not really anybody's actually tone deaf. And that it, when you have cultures or societies, more like indigenous cultures or such, where that are also more community society based, that they do singing kind of constantly all together as a culture. You don't find anybody who just doesn't know how to sing. But nowadays we sort of specialize, and you might not know how to sing.
So this is a really interesting field of study. And I think that the sort of that there is nobody tone deaf, I have heard that as well. And I think the jury's kind of out on it, essentially. It's what's certainly true is that some forms of musical intuition seem to be kind of just ubiquitous in human life. Like the impulse to move with a beat, the impulse to think about melody and rhythm as a kind of motion. There have been studies done, sort of cultural studies done to sort of try to isolate the elements of music that are, you might say, universal. And some of those have been quite successful. That is also a good example of something that the Greeks were well aware of and thought a lot about. So again, going back here to Plato, you know, Plato's very interested in music as one of the fundamental kind of answers to our very, very youthful impulses. So before we kind of really get around to thinking logically, before we grow into the full-fledged beings that we are, Plato thinks that we have these impulses to move. And he gives a lot of different stories about how that comes to be. One is that, you know, when our souls get put into bodies, they become disoriented. And so they start to get kind of moving. You know, this is, I'm thinking here of the Timaeus, one of his big dialogues. And the takeaway from all of that, because of course, you know, people think of these myths as kind of kooky, but they're really just ways of describing these kind of very basic, foundational human things. The takeaway, and especially in Plato's Laws, from all of this, is that music answers this impulse that we have to move as infants. And nurses, this is why nurses rock babies and sing to them, is because there's this kind of, you know, rhythmic motion that's very satisfying to them, based on the fact that not only is music at that very fundamental level in the human heart, it's also the whole, on some level, it is an expression of the mathematics that govern the cosmos. And we still believe it to be true that music has some kind of mathematical basis, that the harmonies are in mathematical ratios to one another. And, you know, for Plato and for many others after him, that sort of consonance is why we all kind of want to do this. And one of the central ways that music can kind of help us is by bringing our soul movements back in tune with the movements of the universe, which again sounds kooky until you think, well, actually, we do currently study the neurological patterns of music and the way that it affects our brain waves and so forth. There's a Harvard study done recently that, you know, people can understand certain impulses and moods in music even without knowing the language of the song. So if I were to listen to a song in Urdu or indeed even Mandarin, there would potentially be some kind of emotional connection there, which is related again to kind of the math behind the universe, to physics.
Now, I mean, I always think, though, if you have the pitch in a language, like say in Cantonese or Mandarin, that is so confining. I mean, I sounds a bit harsh, but I'm not a big fan of Chinese opera. Because they kind of have to follow the pitch. So the music is less free to do what it wants to do.
So, right. This is a really interesting sort of situation. Some amount of this, I think, we can chalk up to acculturation. I know that I have encountered musical traditions before, not the Chinese musical tradition in particular, but, you know, Arabic music, for example, where you first hear it, and Greek music also, because Greek music has quarter tones in it, just sort of smaller intervals than we have. And first you start to hear it and you go, I don't know, it kind of jars. And then eventually over time, your ear gets used to it. And if it's truly structured in some kind of recognizable way and not just random, then there's a degree to which you can kind of acculturate yourself to different form of music. That having been said, there may also just be kind of unbreachable gaps here. You may kind of get to a certain age, a certain point, and just not feel. I mean, there have been studies, interesting studies done on speakers of Mandarin and the ways in which their brain patterns develop as they are taught to speak with tones. So the recognition of pitch is much stronger on average among native speakers of Mandarin for precisely the reasons you indicate. And then, like, you know, the fact of relative pitch, which is what Mandarin uses, right? You don't actually have to speak at a certain pitch. You don't have to speak at A flat in Mandarin, you know, and then move up to B flat or these absolute pitches. You just move from high to low or from low to high and so forth. And so that sensitivity to that is typically much stronger in people who have grown up from very early age. And we talk now about neuroplasticity, right? The idea that your brain is kind of forming these permanent pathways very young, when you're very young. And that might just kind of harden harden your mind against certain forms of music, and vice versa. It might just mean that you do not hear certain things as beautiful. And so there's, you know, people always make this either or, you know, either music is universal or we can never experience other cultures' music. We can never appropriate other cultures' music. The reality, of course, is somewhere in between. You know, the as children, Plato and Aristotle knew, and we know that as children, we develop these habituations that are very, very hard to get over. You're never going to kind of just jettison the way you were taught as a baby to hear music. But we also, you know, throughout our lives, we can kind of experience new forms of music. And there are some underlying kind of structures, especially the fourth is a very common underlying structure for a scale. You know, here comes the bride is really central to a lot of scales. So any scale that's built on that, you can kind of start to learn, I think, to appreciate over time. But that doesn't mean that you know, will ever love Chinese opera. It just means that there's some plasticity there.
But I guess I just never realized how much crossover there would be between like music and linguistics. But of course, it makes sense. But when you come to think about it, kind of thing. But like all children have the ability to hear every single sound that exists, and that within the mm-hmm. first, you know, 6 months to a year and a half, I think, is when we close down the ability to distinguish. And then, you know, if you're a Japanese speaker, you might not be able to hear the difference between an L and an R as easily, or you know, we struggle with a lot of different sounds once we kind of limit the number of ones. So, I mean, I guess you could have it that like all music could potentially sound good to you depending on what you listen to as a kid.
Right. I mean, again, all music that, so it's not just a free for all, right? I mean, there are certain, I believe, certain patterns that are mathematical and therefore inherent in the universe in exactly the way that ancient scholars thought, you know. And so the fifth and the fourth, for example, are intervals that undergird a huge number of scales, not just Western scales. But right, yeah, I think when people talk about education as some form of soulcraft, you know, this is a way of thinking that has become popular again recently, and fell out of favor in the 20th century in America with Dewey and these kind of other theorists of education. But to make a long story short, right, there is a long history of thinking about education, not just as get the information that you need, but shape your soul toward virtue and away from vice. And music is kind of and people have thought about music like this, about this in this way forever, that music is the purified sort of essence of the stuff that we talk around in language. And one of the reasons that the ancient theorists often wanted babies to be listening to music, and Schubert actually was famous for talking about this too, is because this stuff inheres in the universe in a purely non-mystical way, in a purely, you know, physical, mathematical way, that our, if you like, our animal selves are attuned to even before our developed brains can explain in some more rational sense why that is. And these forms of acculturation that happen very early on in youth are tremendously important for kind of enabling us to do what you would call the higher functions, to think. And there, of course, have been studies of babies listening to music in the womb who are then better at math and all of that stuff. So again, these forms of thought are still with us. They're not outdated or defunct. They're just, in many cases, you find them expressed in different ways in ancient texts than you would find them today in a scientific paper.
Now, are there certain types of music that are better than others? Like, I mean, when I was a teenager, I was very much into things like, you know, Marilyn Manson and Tool and Korn. And totally. I can't possibly imagine anybody putting that to a womb and saying, this is going to help the baby be better at math. So, and people you know, obviously do blame that music on having very negative effects on people. I mean, was there an ancient example of bad music? And I still like listening to from time to time. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily bad. Well, I don't know. You tell me.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So this is such a fraught and fun question. It's fun because it's fraught, and it's fraught because it's fun. Like it, yes, there were ancient versions of bad music. In fact, Plato is famous for having exiled basically everybody that doesn't praise the gods in something like the Dorian mode from his city. And his concerns, he has a lot of different concerns. in many cases to do with mimesis, so sort of imitation, that if you kind of pretend to be somebody you're not, that's bad. But also he wants a certain kind of citizen. He wants a kind of upright military citizen. And so his Socrates in the Republic is very suspicious of such things as the Mixolydian mode, which is for threnody, for the wailing of keening mothers in grief. And he wants to basically stiffen the spine of his citizens. Now, to some extent, this may be ironic, this may be extreme. And Aristotle is famous in his Politics for having kind of opened the door a little bit wider. So he says, yes, you know, there are certain forms of music that shape the soul for virtue, but there's also the possibility of music just for pleasure, right? And you might put Manson like in that box if you wanted to fit your music tastes into the Greek mode. You might put Manson in that box, and I would put like, yeah, I listen to a lot of sort of just dumb pop music, and I don't think it really like edifies me, but I also don't consider it a pure vice, and hard rock, all that stuff. But there are other arguments to be made that all of this is just kind of theorists getting mad at artists for doing what artists do. You know, I mean, there's a whole realm of this that we haven't really talked quite so much about, which is that the philosophers in the ancient world are the ones whose writing was preserved. And except for these few documents, the musicians didn't always leave a lot behind. And so their own arguments for artistic freedom and for the freedom of the audience to sort of experience the full range of human expression were sometimes, you know, were lost. And now in the West, we have a very vibrant tradition of making that argument. I would make a qualified version of that argument, I would say. There is actually, you know, it's not, art is not just a free-for-all. You can't just expose yourself to sort of limitless violence and nihilism without having it filter into your soul to a certain extent. And you do feel after a while, like, gosh, I gotta put this aside for a second. But also the world of human emotion and experience is much bigger and messier than theorists often like to let on. So if you sort of set out to say, I'm only going to listen to what's good, you are likely to miss a lot. Now, I think at the moment our society probably errs on the side of the free-for-all. So I would be personally in favor of a little bit more kind of consciousness and awareness about how we expose ourselves to art. But I would hate to see that motion go so far back in the other direction that we can't acknowledge things that don't fit into our theories that are nevertheless obviously good art.
Well, and you can just say, like, just acknowledging that the impact music can have on the way you think or you feel, that does have an influence, and so that you should be conscious of, when choosing music, how it's going to make you feel.
Absolutely. And kids are different, right? This is the other thing we always forget in these conversations, is that adults who have been well-trained in music appreciation are and should be free to make their own choices, including incorporating some of the, I mean, you and I were talking about cigars before we started recording, and like, you know, every adult has like a vice, and if they don't, they're not really human, you know? But you never give a cigar to a 5-year-old. And I think that we tend to think, well, if we're going to have an artistic free for all for adults, we have to then have it for children. But I don't think that's true at all. I think you can think very carefully, as many of these ancient theorists we've been talking about, Plato and Aristotle, did. Think about what kids should learn in school and how they should be trained to appreciate music for their own health and flourishing. I mean, not for like some abstract idea about how we think they should live, but just, you know, tried and true over time, we happen to know that certain forms of thought are ennobling and uplifting. Others are nihilist and self-destructive, and that we shouldn't be ashamed, I don't think, of telling our kids or training our kids to live well. But, you know, this is called the paedagoges in Greek, the sort of nurse. And Paul, actually, in his letters, uses this as an example. The paedagoges is the nurse that kind of raises the kid up to a certain period of maturity so that he can have freedom. And that maturity is the sort of prerequisite for being able to go out and listen to Manson and enjoy it. I think that's like perfectly easy to say that without saying, and now we must kick all the poets out of our ideal city.
So we should basically be introducing music theory into primary schools.
Absolutely. And Latin as well. Yes.
Hear, hear. I agree.
Amen. Yeah, totally.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I think it's so, I could talk to you for hours about this subject. I think it's absolutely fascinating, but I do appreciate you taking so much time to talk to me about this today. And it's really fascinating. And maybe we could just finish up by letting me know what you're working on now.
Yeah, first of all, it's been such a pleasure. It's always wonderful to chat about this stuff. I think if people have enjoyed our conversation, they will enjoy this book that is coming out. I believe it's coming out next year. But you can go now onto Bloomsbury's website and just search Spencer A. Clavin, Music in Ancient Greece. And my book, which is currently in proofreads, will be there for you. So pre-order it, do whatever. I am also currently an editor at the Claremont Review of Books, which is a great publication that often includes reflections of this kind by me, but also by others. And I have a podcast called Young Heretics, which is one that people might love if they love this podcast. So those are all ways to find my work. And thank you for asking.
Wonderful. And I think also, if we can, I might ask you for some links to be able to listen to some of the ancient Greek music that we've been discussing so that people can get the full experience.
Absolutely. I'm in favor of that. So yeah, I will send you some YouTube links.
Perfect.